Welcome to Crowd Forecast News, episode number 187 for July 2nd, 2018. We are broadcasting live on YouTube at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, but all Time and Research shows are also now available as audio-only podcasts. So you can look them up on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Today we will be discussing the 249th weekly report. If you you should be seeing it on your screen while I'm talking right now, but if you like to download it or read the full report, you can go to timingresearch.com and find it there. My name is David Kosmeter. I'm the creator of timingresearch.com, and I have Rob Hannebeck to moderate today. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to him.
Hi, thanks, thanks, David. Great to be back here again. Today we have Jim Kenny of Option Professor with us, as well as Neil Bathow of TraderReview.net, and myself. So before we get into the deep discussion, let me let those guys introduce themselves a little bit, and I'll tell you a little bit more about myself if you're not familiar with me. Neil, let's start with you. Do you want to give us a little bit about your background as a trader and about your site and your how you trade?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on the show again, David. So I was a broker back in 98, 99 at a major firm, and they called us investment executives back then. And I quickly learned that you're not actually going to be an analyst. It just turned out to be more of a sales job, which I wasn't interested in doing so much. I just wanted to make money for my clients, make great picks. And in our training, and it's the same with all broker training, they tell you that really your only job is to take the assets from your client's account and then just transfer them to your account. And a lot of firms get paid on percent of assets. So they just say, grow the assets, grow the assets. And then what I realized in the training is, you know, if the market, or no, after the training, when I first started having some clients and just trying to get a client to make one pick, I still remember, you know, I was saying, you know, I think it was Sun Microsystems. I mean, that stock went crazy, but I said, we should buy this stock. And it went up a few hundred percent, you know, after I left the firm. But he said, well, you know, I got to talk to my neighbor. He knows about this kind of stuff. Got to get back to you. Then I thought to myself, what's going to happen when I have 100 clients? I can't make 100 phone calls like this. I'll never be able to make the pick. And so then I did learn a lot. It was a great time. We got fantastic free lunches from mutual funds, and which is great when you're right out of college because you're always starving. And it was really a dream true for me. But after that, I did some business consulting for a while. And then I started up Trader Review with technical analysis that I actually learned a bit when I was a broker. And then I taught it to myself later on. It's a point and figure charting with the X's and O's. It's a fantastic methodology. I still use it. I think it's really the best overall methodology out there. I'll explain a little bit later in the show about it. And I just send out picks to my clients based on that methodology.
Okay, interesting. I haven't done a whole lot of work myself with the point and figure. So it'll be good to get to talk to you and hear some point and figure perspectives. Jim, good to be able to talk to you again. Jim Kenny, the Option Professor.
Yep.
Why don't you give us a little bit of background on you? I mean, I know it a little bit, but yep, you can say it better than I can to the people.
Thanks. I have been producing the content for Option Professor now for many, many, many years. And the idea of Option Professor is to try to get individual investors and other people knowledgeable about how the uses and the risks of the options market work and all the different ways you can use them, from just using them as limited risk leverage positions, trading them, rolling up, rolling down, using them in concert with other positions as a hedge, possibly things like collars or married puts, and also to replace positions go from a higher risk area cash-wise into a limited risk area. And then, of course, the different ways of playing both sides of the market with spreads and straddles and strangles combinations, positions, and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of different ways to use them. They all have a unique use and risk. And a lot of people are out there for the last couple of decades not really knowing how the product works. So what we try to do is fill in that gap so people know what these things can do for you, and hopefully they choose wisely.
All right, great. Looking forward to hearing your perspectives today as well. And I'm Rob Hanna. For those of you that don't know me, I began trading, we'll start back then, in the late 90s. I started trading full-time in 2001, And I used to write for Larry Connor's site, TradingMarkets.com, back in the early 2000s. In 2008, I started QuantifiableEdges.com. I still run that today. And in 2014, I joined forces with Scott Andrews to start InvestiQuant.com. I'm a co-founder there, and I do a lot of the swing and overnight trading stuff at InvestiQuant. I'll tell you a little bit more at the end of the podcast about those. My primary focus is swing trading, and I use quantitative methods for the most part. I also normally dress better than this, but I wore a t-shirt today because I did an MS fundraiser over the weekend. I biked from all the way around Cape Cod. It was 150 miles and 2 days in the heat. And so I'm wiped out, but I'll tell you about a special offer I got going on at Quantifiable Edges if you donate to the MS Foundation. We'll get to that later on. Let's get to the questions, though. So let me start off by just doing a quick check to see what side we're all on here as far as do we think the market's going to be moving higher or lower, just to kind of put it in perspective. And without getting into any details yet, we'll just go through the list. I'll start. I'm bullish from now until Friday. Jim, are you bullish or bearish?
Yeah, I think the probabilities right now may favor a little bit of a rally.
Okay. And Neil, are you with us or against us? I'm hoping you're against us. It makes the discussion more interesting.
Market's going down.
Oh, there we go. All right. Okay, good. So it's we'll have some good back and forth here. And I'm seeing reasons for both. So maybe I'm seeing some of the same stuff as Neil, but my inclination, based on a lot of my studies, is up. Let me let you guys talk first. Neil, why don't I start with you, since you're the dissenter, I guess. What's making you think that it's going to be headed down this week?
Okay, just going to bring up the charts here. I'm going to give away my big secret indicator. It's the best indicator I've ever found in 15 years, and I don't think you're ever going to be able to find a better one. So that, of course, means there's a better one, right? So here it is. You can all see these X's and O's here.
Yep.
Okay, so you can see that this scale, it goes from 0 to 100, just starts at 2 because it hasn't gone any lower than that. But what this chart does is it shows what percent of stocks in the S&P 500 are on near-term buy signals. And so that's when a stock has broken out, the typical left to right, it breaks out from a previous high. They're point and figure based, but that's the best way to explain it. And it just reversed down into O's here on Friday. And so there used to be 64% of stocks with decent near-term technicals in the market. And now it's reversed down 58 and now here over at 56. And almost every time I see this, I think there was only one time I didn't see this happen. The market is down the very next day. So this reversed on Friday during the day. And then Monday, the market is down at the open over 100, 150 points or so on the Dow in the morning. And the guys at the CBOE use this indicator. They use point and figure there, a lot of the old timers. And this is really the best indicator that I've ever seen. And I'll show you another one that will be a little bit easier to read. Just take a second to bring it up. This one went down a few days before, even like the last 2 weeks. It's the percent of stocks in the S&P 500 above their 50-day moving average. So you look back here, it was around 75, and now it reached 50. It's 53. So think about the entire S&P 500 index. Only about half the stocks are above their 50-day moving average. So that's really weak. So I think it's going to lead to more of a breakdown. And I don't really even have to bring up of the S&P 500 to sort of get that bearish sentiment.
So the S&P 500, I'm looking at it as of Friday. The 53 doesn't seem surprising to me, being that it closed almost right at the 50-day moving average. I mean, the S&P 500 closed almost right at its 50-day moving average.
So it's kind of funny how half the stocks are above and half the stocks aren't.
Yeah. Interesting to point out there, though. And is it the dive down that normally you find pushes things below?
It sort of depends on the overall chart of the S&P 500. If you look here, I use Ichimoku Cloud as well. So you sort of have some support on the cloud. But what's actually happening here, I can't really draw on here, I don't think, but you can see the chart here. You have a shoulder.
A daily chart?
Yeah, it's a daily chart of S&P. So you have one shoulder here, then you have a head. And another shoulder over here. And what's funny is that when you do the Series 7 exam, which is the broker exam, it's actually a really, really hard exam. About 30% fail it. And if you fail it, you don't go to work the next day. So my boss actually came in and to my office. He said, hey, is your exam tomorrow? Which was a Friday, I think. I said, yeah, it is. He said, good luck or don't come in on Monday. And he laughed and walked away. I'll never forget. And then I came in on Monday and then everyone sees you and they clap and it's this big kind of fun thing. And they say, you made it. You didn't fail. But the only technical pattern on the entire exam, and there's no technical analysis added on it at all, except head and shoulders. So that's how important they think the head and shoulders pattern is. So you can never ignore it if they think it's that important to put it on an exam that supposedly doesn't believe in technicals. So that's what I'm looking at here, possible head and shoulders, maybe down 26-40, maybe not this week, but maybe by the end of next week.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Jim, let's go to you. Where are you seeing some hope this week? You indicate things are going to head up.
Yeah, last Monday we broke very, very hard, and everyone was very, very bearish. And I was saying that with this type of volume imbalance and the area of 2700 right there, if this selling abates at all, you're going to get a good bounce out of there. And if you're an aggressive trader, you should be buying against that 2680, 2700 area. And we did get a bounce. Now that was last Monday. This Monday here, we're getting some selling, but it's not quite as panicky feeling as some of the other indexes are down, but they're not egregiously down. And around the world, the indexes aren't falling apart. So my feeling is this is a deteriorating market. There's no doubt in my mind on that. But it is also a market that really isn't falling apart. We're only about, 5 or 6% off of the highs, despite all the rhetoric of this, that, and the other. So it's essentially still a strong situation. Now, you start breaking under 2680, and then you're going to start, and if the VIX gets above 20, then you'd want to get, I think you'd want to get on the sell side. So, my line in the sand is around 20 on the VIX and around 2680, 2690, where we just hit. We start taking out those lows, the VIX gets above 20, and there's going to be trouble in the heartland big time. When you're trading, you got to be flexible. So when I say it might go up this week, I could turn on a dime because, you just don't get married to one opinion very long, especially if you're short-term trading. So right now, we're at 2690, 2700 on the bottom. We're testing it down here. Could it break like Neil's talking about? Well, the thing's deteriorating, so of course it could break. And might it, pop a little bit here this week if people want to cover before the holiday, and then the Fed minutes on Thursday, balance sheet Thursday, Friday you got unemployment, you get a decent number on unemployment, and maybe you go up towards that 2750 area. There's a couple of gaps maybe up there. That's all I'm seeing right now, because I think we are still in the same thing I've been talking about, which is a trading range, which started after we had that blow off top in January. And a trading range is what we're in. So what is a trading range? It looked very good for a while, then it goes back down, looked very bad for a while, then it goes back up for a while. And if you buy strength and you sell weakness, you'll probably have a cardboard box on the corner saying, lost all my money in the trading range, please feed me. So, because you can go through a lot of dough if you're looking for a trending market in a trading range, because it ain't just happening. So, that's basically what I'm saying. I have a very strong viewpoint on what's going on right now, which I'll get to later in the broadcast. And I got a very strong viewpoint on what I think the rest of the year will be. So this summer doldrum would not be a time to go to sleep at the wheel, but I think it'd be an opportunity to start planting your seeds for a fall and winter growing season that could be very substantial. And I'll get into that later in the broadcast.
Okay, good. It looks like the overnight futures got hit a little bit by the LeBron James joining the Lakers news.
I know that didn't fly in Boston. I know that much.
No, we're fine with it in Boston. He's out of the East. Go ahead, go play out there.
We got to start betting on sports on this show. We have to do it. I gotta have a sports section of my newsletter. I swear, every once in a while, I swear, you just know, don't you think?
Yep,
I just know it. You can bet on the Lakers to win the championship. I bet you now on some sites. I wonder what the odds are.
My son told me this morning that before he went to Los Angeles, the odds of Cleveland winning it next year were 10-1, and now they're 500-1.
Oh. I wish we had some puts on that. That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
I think the Red Sox and the Yankees are schizophrenic because one day one beats them by 11 to nothing, and the next day the other one beats them 9-0. So I think there's some schizophrenic pills that are needed, medication for those teams out there.
Yeah, you're right, and it doesn't make it for too exciting a baseball. So Jim, you made one point about the support here, which was you mentioned around the 2690 area. And that's the recent lows that you're pointing at there for the S&P, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then one thing I've noticed is that we're really not that far above, like at 2670, you got the 200-day moving average now. So would you, that has seemed to act as some support in February, April, and the beginning of May. I would think that would have a chance to act as some support again as it's continued to bounce. Do you look at the 200 at all? Is that something that you?
I think the trading range scenario that I've been speaking about since January, the hourglass is running out of time, mm-hmm. meaning you're getting a convergence on the 50 and the 200 day, which means you're no longer at 2900 on the S&P with the 200 day at 2400. Right. That ridiculous joke, which was happening in January. So the excesses have all been taken out of the market. And like I was going to say later in the broadcast, but I'll briefly just say now, I think there's a number of markets that are on a ledge, and that ledge will not last. And there'll be some activity around this ledge in the next 8 weeks. And then as the kids start going back to school and we start looking at, leaves on the ground, there's going to be some changes coming up here. And I think this summer doldrums and working off the excesses of January are going to be behind us, and there's going to be some action in that time frame that I'm talking about.
Okay. All right, good. I'll look forward to hearing more of your thoughts on that a little later too. All right. So I'll give my input on the short term here as far as some of the things that I've been seeing. For one, at InvestiQuant, we have what we call our swing edges guides, and they look at a number of different systems. So it's momentum-based systems, acceleration-based systems, we call them, and seasonality-based systems. And there's three of each. There's a one-day, a three-day, and a five-day, and they all use different indicators, but they're trying to measure that similar type of seasonality is measured a number of different ways, and we look for one-day and three-day and five-day. And what it does is it looks back historically and says under similar circumstances, how often has the market been higher over the next one or three or five days? And then what's been the profit factor if you were to have gone long? Profit factor being gross gains divided by gross losses if you took every instance where this setup occurred. And the numbers at IQ right now are quite strong. Pull that up for myself to look at. So the 5 day numbers, well, we're looking 4 days here. So the 3 day numbers are showing a 59.9% win rate and a 1.61 profit factor. The 5 day are showing a 61.2 and a 1.52 profit factor. So really right around a 60% chance of a move higher and a profit factor of about 1.55, which means you historically would have made about 55% more than you would have lost on such bets over time. And I generally view anything above 55% and 1.3 as pretty good or as bullish. So these are good numbers that we're seeing, and they're giving me some optimism. I also saw, I looked at a few studies over the weekend based on the patterns I've been seeing. So one study looked at the SPX, and it looked at any time after closing at a 20-day low 2 days ago, and the 20-day low in this case would have been on Wednesday, S&P closed up 2 days in a row, but was still below the close of 3 days ago. In other words, it didn't make up for that one-day drop. It didn't make up for Wednesday's drop on Thursday and Friday. Whenever that's happened from 2000 to the present, there's been 21 instances coming off a 20-day low, like I mentioned. 3 days later, 17 of the 21 were higher, and the average made about 0.9% over the 3 days. Another interesting study I looked at. I looked back to the inception of the SPY, and it just looked at all times that SPY closed in the bottom 10% of its intraday range, like it did on Friday with the big sell-off at the close, or near the end of the day. So it closed the bottom 10% of its intraday range, but still up on the day. So when that's happened, there's been 34 instances going back to 1993. 27 out of 34, or about 79%, have closed higher 3 days later, and the average instance gained or closed up 0.8% 3 days later. So those are just a couple things that I'm seeing that are pointing to the upside that are making me think we got a good chance to bounce here in the next few days. So that's an example of the stuff I'm looking at, and that's why I came in and said I was a bullish. Let's go back and let me ask you, Neil. Are there things that you are looking at this upcoming week that would get you to either feel that you're, you know, that would confirm your stance, or your bias, excuse me, your bearish bias, or that would cause you to flip your bearish bias, either fundamental things or news events you're looking at, like the employment report coming out Friday? Do you think that's a big deal? Or technical factors, you know, are there technical factors that you say, all right, well, if it goes above here or below there or whatever, that would change my possibly change my bias, and so I'm on the lookout for that. Is there anything you're on the lookout for?
Yeah, sure. I mean, sort of my whole basic hypothesis of what moves the market is growth rate expectations. So the only way the market's going to go up is if the growth rate doesn't just stay the same, it gets better and better all the time. So, you know, if you look at something company specific, let's say they have a 20% growth rate, and then the next quarter, a 21% growth rate, 22% growth rate. And then they say, you know, we're still selling more products than ever before. Next quarter will be our best quarter ever, but it's only going to be a 19% growth rate. I mean, you got to sell that stock for the next year or two. I mean, it's going to drop 30%, these types of things. So I think in the market, I mean, how much better can it get? How much better can the economy get? You know, it's got great numbers. Optimism is at a huge peak. So I guess if any sort of consumer sentiment might come out that's even higher than it was last time, that would be good for the market, sort of trading, I guess you would say. But I've seen kind of some contrarian signals. They're kind of funny, but I've actually learned never to ignore them. One of the most fun things you can ever do, if you're ever at the airport, you walk by a newsstand, look at the news covers, all the magazines, and do the exact opposite of what they say, especially The Economist. That is the most ridiculous. They are so far behind the curve, you can't even imagine. The Economist is like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the phone. I mean, they'll just kick that football every time, and Lucy will pull it away, and they'll just keep falling for it. So it's really hilarious. But I found this article. I'm just going to bring it up here. This is just a classic. It's about millennials. Rich millennials buy more stocks, but don't rely on them. And then if I go down here, flush millennials keep more in cash, but have been much more aggressive in equities over the past year. Now, these were kids that were 11, 12, 15, 16 years old during the 2008-9 crash, and know absolutely nothing about the tech crash in 2000, 2003, like all of this stuff. So they've moved most of it into stocks, to 46% allocation from 25%. And I see something like this and I think, oh, okay, these guys have a sort of a entitlement type of mentality, and I don't take these things lightly actually when I see them. And I'll think about these types of indicators when I trade and I see the market breaking down. I think, yeah, millennials are going to complain in about 6 months that the whole market's rigged, everyone's against them, it's all insiders making the money, you know, all these types of things. And so this is a real fun type of thing. I'm always on the lookout for this type of stuff. And, you know, let's say you'll see a magazine at the airport, I don't know, Money or something, and it'll say like a huge bowl on it. It'll say, how much more can the market go? Are you ready for the new paradigm? And that's when you get real, real scared. And so, you know, I'm always out on the lookout for these types of things. So unless things get extraordinarily better, better than anyone ever imagined, as far as optimism goes, I'm not really looking for new highs in the markets till, if we're lucky, you know, November.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Yeah. I hadn't seen that article before, so thanks for pointing that out. Jim, let me ask you a similar question. Are there things upcoming this week that could change your mind, that make you think of that'll either confirm or refute your bias and have you rethinking things?
Well, obviously, we're going to have Fed minutes, and we're going to have Fed balance sheet, and then we're going to get an unemployment report, and then we're going to slap tariffs on people. So there's a lot of meat on the sandwich here, and the meat could be rotten or it could be very fresh. We're going to find that out sooner rather than later. One thing I just wanted to say briefly about Neil, what he was saying is so true on a personal level. I dodged a pretty big bullet in January because I was very seduced by the story of the banks and seduced by the story of emerging markets and seduced by the story of Europe. You know, Europe was cheaper than us, so it's going to be great. Growth rates in their emerging markets were going to be great, so that was going to be great. And, of course, the banks are going to make all this money when they dereg and do all the rest of it. And if you put a lot of dough in there in January, which I was thinking about doing because I was kind of seduced, the story made a lot of sense, it seemed like. Fortunately, I never made it to my wallet on that one because it would be a nightmare. I'd be down like 20%, 30%, or if you're in stocks like on the Goldman Sachs, you'd be really whacked here. And, you know, so it's just another example of what Neil was saying, that when things are popular, that means participation is already pretty high. And when people are complacent, when things, you know, if it starts raining and you just stand there, don't get an umbrella, don't get a raincoat, you know, you can get pretty wet. Just thinking that the rain is definitely going to stop. So I just wanted to make an aside on a personal level that what Neil was talking about is quite accurate. You got to be careful when things are extremely popular because that means participation has already occurred quite a bit in some cases.
Yeah, I'm looking at the iShares of like, so you look at IEV, which is Europe, and that's gone from, to back up your point, that's gone from about 51 down to, it's trading at 44 right now. And you look at the emerging markets, right? That's, I look at EM for that, and that's similar. It's gone from 52 down to, it's not even worse, down to 42 right now. So it's lost about 20%.
Yeah, great bargains often become much better bargains is what you tend to notice.
Well, because a lot of people are in there, and a lot of people bet up, and maybe they're gritting their teeth, and they're, you know, going through that laundry list of, well, it'll turn around. Well, I'll give it time. Well, I'm in there for the long run. And then, you know, they whack it pretty hard, and all of a sudden they say, screw all that stuff, just get me out. Yeah.
A long-term investment is a short-term investment gone wrong.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I mean, obviously, if you get in after a crash of 08, you know, and you, you know, put something on long and you let it ride as long as you can, that's a different story. It's when you're getting in at that's the all-time highs, that's not the same as getting in 08, 09, or 10, or 11. You know what I mean? But at any rate, yeah, this week we could have some stuff going on there, and that's going to be interesting. But, you know, like I say, if Neil's going to be accurate, it's probably because the people are still complacent out there, and the participation is quite high, and the market makers and the guys who want to do their buybacks probably would like to buy it back during a flush. And so, you know, there's always going to be that risk that they may do a very major flush and use these tariff, you know, scenarios that they've got floating around. I mean, the trade deficit, as far as I can see, is, you know, it's kind of silly to think that we have a 19 trillion GDP. Canada has like 1.75. You know, they're never going to buy as much stuff from us as we buy from them because of the sheer enormity of the difference between the two economies. And they're not going to not buy German cars in Germany, because then all the Germans wouldn't have a job. So, you know, it's just silly on so many levels, but it's a political thing. And like many things that are going on, there's headline stuff going on. But, and of course, the administration is betting that we're 19 trillion and these other countries are 1 trillion and 2 trillion and maybe Japan is 4 trillion. You know, so really they're all small players. But if they all get together, they're a big player. And I think that's what they're trying to do here is rather than just roll over and play dead, they're getting together and trying to fight the tariff war in a cumulative fashion. But I think, you know, like I say, by the next 2 months, whatever we're doing with this tariff talk and all that stuff may very well get behind us more than it will get crazy, because some of the objectives, you know, I just don't think are reasonable. And once they become obviously not reasonable, then, you know, these things can go the other way.
One of the things about the U.S. and with the trade deficit, a lot of people don't realize you have a trade deficit. You have money leaving your country. You know, I mean, more money is going out of your country than it's going in your country. And so one of the biggest exports, probably the biggest export of the entire United States, is actually inflation. So you're sending all this money overseas. And now I'm sort of wondering if the money supply you know, if there's more deficits and more cash being in staying in the domestic United States, what that's actually going to do to inflation if this all works out. And I don't have a lot of research on that, but if there's the more money there is in a certain location, the less value it's going to have. So I think for a long, long, long time, the US has just been printing money and exporting that money overseas. And you don't notice it, you don't feel it as bad at home. So it's going to be interesting. I got to do some more research on that. Maybe if there's any to be had, but I'll probably spend my time making picks instead. So,
but you were thinking that the inflation may pick up if these things shake us.
That's what the rational mind would say, but you always have to confirm that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if.
But right now, the gold and the silver look like they're betting the other way a little bit.
Maybe, yeah. I'm so not bullish on gold at all.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I had to say about that. It's just how the U.S., its biggest export ever is inflation. So it's going to be interesting to see if all these things work out. But you know what? All that Trump does in every single deal that he does, it's straight out of his book, Art of the Deal, where first you offer a bad deal, they reject the bad deal, and then you come up with a better deal and look like you're the deal maker that made an awesome deal. And everyone's happy because you sort of look like you gave a little bit and agreed with them when no one would agree with the first deal in the first place. And he uses this every single time, and he's doing it again, saying he'll say I'm going to charge tariffs on this, and then after a while he say, oh, you know, I gave them a break or whatever, but that was his plan all the whole time, and everyone falls for it because no one read his book.
maybe so. The sophistication level of the person he's dealing with now is higher than what he did in the book, though, you know.
What are you talking about? I read that book in third grade.
Right. It's an old book. He's sticking to it, I guess.
I'm saying that's his plan. That's how he does the deals. Offer bad deals, deal, and then everyone's happy. He's doing a better deal. So.
China's reading another book called The Art of War. God.
Deficits for dummies. I don't know. Sure. Okay. Well, I'm just trying to make up stuff as I go along here. I just was making some real serious money supply comments, and everything got all twisted. What's next, Rob?
I just thought I'd point out one other thing that I'm looking at that we just haven't discussed yet, which is, Jim brought up the Fed and the meeting, the minutes, and all that coming this week, but. There was a huge maturation of treasuries on Saturday. It was on the 30th. And that was about a little over $30 billion. And they will probably not renew about $18 billion of them. The final number will come out Thursday afternoon on their website. But up until June, it was $40 billion a month. I'm sorry, $30 billion a month that they were rolling off the books. Right, so treasuries will mature, and up until now, or up until last October, they would reinvest the money into new treasuries. Well, now they're not doing that as much, and it's both treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. So about $18 billion a month in treasuries, and about $12 billion a month in mortgage backs, and that's now that it's July, moving up to from $30 billion to $40 billion. And what I've seen is that these non-renewals, that's basically, it affects liquidity. So there's not as much liquidity available, and the market feels the pain. Just as QE helped push the market higher, QT is making things more difficult. It's gone from a big tailwind to a big headwind. So liquidity events are more likely to happen. And this week, being that we just had this big maturation, is one week where we could see liquidity a bit tighter. And maybe the market reacted to that leading into it on Friday, right? The market knew that there was going to be less liquidity because they post the schedule, but it may not have all gotten out of there. So we'll see. I've done a fair amount of studies on this, and you can download a free report I did over at Quantifiable Edges. I'm trying to remember the title of it. It's like trading with based on Fed action or something. But you can find it over at quantifiableedges.com. Someone's Googling it. So anyway, I'll keep an eye on that, and that could be a big detriment this week. Next week, not as much of a big deal. There shouldn't be as much maturing. But now that we're getting into the $40 billion a month, it's going to get steeper and steeper. So yeah, it was the Fed-based, quantifiable edges for Fed-based market timing or something like that. It just, someone flashed it up. I'll give you the title or a link later on. All right, let's go to the questions of the week. And it's interesting. The responses on the website from the readers were mixed in my eyes. Either they were talking about a specific trade or they were just saying things in general. So you guys can interpret it however you want. The question is, and I'll start with Jim, I guess. What's been your best experience so far as a trader? And that was 4A. And then 4B, what's been your worst experience so far as a trader?
Well, with options, it's generally going to be around volatility, you know, and your best experience is going to be when you're long volatility and the VIX jumps to 50 and your options just go right through the roof and you're making more money than you could ever believe on a position. Or, you know, like I say, it could be on a stock or any type of thing like that. And your worst is going to be that the volatility hit you from left field and for whatever reason, you were not prepared for it. And then obviously positions get a lot further out of hand than they ordinarily would. And so, when you're on the buy side of options, you know, you have a limited risk. And if you catch the volatility jump, we've had some pretty big ones in the last few years, you can obviously make quite a bit of money. And that money can last for a while. And then on the sell side of the options, you can go along winning quite a bit on percentage basis. But if you don't have a hedge on, or if you get caught in a situation where, you know, over the weekend it decides to drop, you know, 5% on the index and the VIX jumps to 50 or something crazy, then obviously that's something that's going to be very painful and cause pretty good damage. So on the option front, generally it's being on the wrong side of the volatility.
Okay. Is there a personal experience you want to share that was especially painful for you or gratifying?
You know, I've been in it for so many, many decades now. You know, obviously there's a lot of scenarios if you trade for decades that you're going to have.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have all kinds of stories to tell. I mean, from biotech stocks you bought from $1.50 out in Norwood, Massachusetts, that runs up to 44. And then, you know,
right
you
near
have,
me.
Yep. You have other scenarios, you know, where they don't work out so well. And people that are listening now that have traded for any length of time, I'm sure they've got their own ups and down stories. Yeah. But the key with options is probably at the end of the day is to try to have a hedge on most all the time, and also to try to be cognizant of the VIX. Like right now, the VIX is at 17. Some people think the median is 15, and somebody thinks a break above 20 would be excessive. So maybe a two-sided trade looking for the VIX to go back to 15 or to break through 20 would be something that would have limited risk and a heck of a lot of potential if you got that volatility coming into the market. And there seems to be a lot of stuff being talked about and a lot of news being hit. And we're going to start hitting the unemployment report and other stuff going on. And this oil's at 74. If it jumps up to 80, that could cause volatility. So the bottom line is there's some things that could move that VIX either down to 15 or up to 20 or better. And so a two-sided trade in this neighborhood would be something that you could price out.
Yeah. Yeah. The employment report is interesting too. You mentioned that. I've studied that over the years, and you know, there's a lot of things that show consistent edges that you can find from a seasonal standpoint. The employment report is one of the streakiest things I've found, where, you know, you might have 15 out of 17, you know, the market will go up on the day of the employment report, and then it'll reverse and you'll see the same thing to the downside. So it's been doing well lately, but that doesn't mean a streak isn't going to start in the other direction, you know? So it's not something I generally depend on, and I haven't, sometimes we'll see I'll see some good studies around it, but it is a little bit scary to trade because like you said, it can create that volatility.
Mm-hmm.
Neil, what about you? Let me read the question again. What's been your best experience so far as a trader, and what's been your worst experience so far as a trader?
I think a lot of my best experiences came when you're really on top of the market all the time, every single day, and you're not letting anything get out from under you, you know. And combined with that, one of the biggest things ever is position sizing. I don't believe you should put in the same amount per trade. I actually have a calculator I had made for me several years ago that will calculate wherever your stop point is. You calculate how much your entire portfolio would drop if you get stopped out on that one pick, and then it will tell you how many shares to buy. So for example, you know, you buy a stock at 43, your stop is at 41 because you're buying very, very close to the trend. You can put a ton in that trade. You can put maybe 50% of your whole portfolio in that trade. Maybe it's an ETF or something like that, where not one announcement is going to have this huge gap down, and you can get great moves. Or a utility stock, you could put in 35% on a utility stock, moves 10%, you get 3.5% of your portfolio. And one of the worst things you can do is if it's a very volatile pick, you're not too sure about it, it's kind of good, and you put in too much, you can have really bad drop in your portfolio, 10% or more. And so I think position sizing and being on top of it every day is really important. So I guess, I was just thinking of something. I think it was Jim, you said earlier in the show, or maybe someone read it in the reports about not buying a pick, or there someone that got talked out of buying a pick by a broker or something like that. And when we were a broker, we kind of had this rule, or someone next to me in the rookie picked. He was a really good salesman, lost people a lot of money in the internet. Boom. He just kept buying. He kept saying, we got to buy more on the pullback, and then the pullback would be even bigger pullback. He'd be on the phone, we got to buy more. I still remember MSGI was the pick. I'm sure it's gone. I still remember the ticker. But what we said was that if a client ever calls you and wants to buy something, you should always buy at least a little bit, because if it goes up, they will never ever forgive you. And it's so true. You know, you could make all this money for a client, but if they say, yeah, I wanted to buy this pick and put in $3,000, I would have made $10,000. They'll forget all the other picks.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So don't ever let your broker stop you. Just put in a little bit. But I think always being on top of it and taking care of that position sizing. If it's a low volatility type of stock, you really like it, I mean, just go for it. Unless it's the type of thing where you're going to have this bad earnings report where it could drop significantly gap down. But an ETF, utility company, something like that, you're catching it in between earnings season. I mean, you can really go for it on that position sizing.
Yeah, so that's an interesting way to look at things. There's a few schools of thought there. And you've brought up both of them, is the, you know, amount per trade, meaning, you know, what percent of your portfolio are you going to take? 10 positions, 10% each, right? Or do you look at it as a risk per trade, which is what you're doing, saying, all right, I want to risk 2% of my portfolio or whatever, 5%, yeah, or whatever it is on the trade. And then, you know, you're not going to get blown up, or you're not going to get killed by one trade if you're overexposed to it, and you can take the same amount of risk per trade.
If it's like a small position, maybe you have $100,000 and you put in even $3,000 on some biotech stop, and you put in a lot of room on that stop, you put in 30% on that stop because it's incredibly volatile and you just hold it, you're going to thank yourself in a year or 9 months later when you get a triple or something out of it. And you're going to think, well, I only made $9,000. If I put my whole portfolio into it, I'd have $300,000, you know? But then would you really have held through that 10, 15% pullback that happened 10 times along the way? Probably not. You probably would have gone crazy not sleeping at night. So right. If you really want to buy something, always just put in at least a little bit and you'll thank yourself later. And you probably won't think too much to yourself, oh, I should have put in the whole account and I'd have that condo by now.
I think that's a big key to trading. Just having a method, right? I mean, so you don't always second guess yourself. I mean, if I put my whole account into all of my winning trades, I'd be Buffett, right? Just avoid all the losers and put the 100% into each winner I've had over the years. So you just can't continue to second guess yourself. But you're right. Like having a good methodology like that will keep you sane and keep you profitable, hopefully.
I think it's also a good idea to scale out too and trade sometimes, depending on the market conditions. Because normally what I find is it's very hard for a stock to make more than a 20% or so move in a period of a month or two. That seems to be some sort of magic number where the stock market just says, sorry, buddy, we're just not going to give you more than 20% all that easily. So if you're getting in the 10, 15, 20% range, take half or so off the table and use it for something else. And maybe even if it breaks out again, you could even put it all back in on the breakout, because that way you're managing your risk as well, even though you would make a tiny bit less. And I mean, I've looked at Apple charts going way, way, way back on point and figure and saying, if I just bought the breakouts on a very long-term chart, I mean, it really just works on point and figure. If I change the box size to about 5% or so, if I only buy the breakouts, I put everything in on a very big breakout and sell it all on a breakdown, you'll outperform the stock from just holding, and it'll be better on a risk basis as well. So,
okay. Yeah. Interesting. Well, thanks, Neil. Best experience as a trader, I guess, has been just overall, I mean, for me, my ability to earn a living and work from home and have freedom. That freedom does come at a price. I work an awful lot. I don't stop working at 4 o'clock. Most of the money I make is after the market closes, when I do my research. All I'm doing from a trading standpoint is executing on my research. You know, I come into the day, I know what I want to buy, I know what I want to sell. I don't day trade. So, I mean, day traders have it differently, but it's not because I don't think day trading can be profitable. It's just because it doesn't suit my lifestyle. But I've been able to build a business around the lifestyle that I want. And that means, if I need to, not be in front of the screen all day, I don't have to be, but that I can, come up with strategies that will allow me to make money and feed the family and do all right. The worst experience as a trader for me was, and you remember the big losses, right? So the most painful losses I had were in August of 2011. And that was, actually it was end of July, 2011. So this was a tough day. It was just one of, you know, I can tell you a bunch of stories when I lost money and a bunch of stories when I made money. But this one was kind of funny, we can look back at it and say it's funny. We were going into the weekend, and I had a bunch of indicators all saying long, 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 long. And so I took some heavy long positions, heavier than I normally do. I mean, not a lot heavier, but, you know, I was about all in, and went out to see a comedy show with my wife. And we were going to see the comedy show for my birthday. It was my birthday at the time. And we get to the show, and she turns on like the news feed on her phone. And as we're walking into the comedy show, she says to me, "Oh, did you see that they downgraded U.S. bonds?" And you know, the market's closed for the whole weekend. And I was like, "Oh my God!" Well, that show wasn't funny at all, because I was like so worked up. I'm so long, and they downgraded bonds for the first time ever in the U.S. And I knew what was going to happen next when it opened on Monday morning. So I took some tough losses there, and it was a lousy way to start the weekend. All right, let me go back through, and we need to wrap it up. But if you guys can, Neil, if you want to offer a trade idea, if you have one for this week, and then also let us know anything you got going on over at traderreview.net. If there's anything you want to tell us about there, that'd be great.
I don't really have a trade this week, unfortunately. I usually have one to give away. Unless you're a covered call type guy, it could be a good week for covered calls. I don't really do that at my service, though. yeah, if you sign up Trader Review, I'll give you that calculator you can install. That'll help you with your trading, the position size of your trading. You can subscribe to my newsletter. I always give a good overall economic outlook, mostly. Well, it's a technical outlook, but I also talk a bit about the fundamentals and how they correlate to one another, fundamentals and technicals. The fundamentals will never bail you out. I'm not sure if I read that somewhere, if I made it up myself, but once something starts going down, you can never think, "Oh no, the fundamentals will bail me out. It's a great company. Don't worry. I'm not too worried about it," because the stock is not always the economy. It's not always a company. So yeah, if you want to sign up, traderreview.net, and I'll get you that calculator.
All right. Thanks, Neil. Jim, how about you? Can you tell us if you have a trade idea for the week, and tell us what's going on over at Option Professor?
Well, basically, because we're at the end of it here, I just wanted to say that I do think that there's a number of markets that are in a zone, which I would consider to be kind of a ledge. And the U.S. dollar between 94 and 96 is in the zone where I think it's a little bit of a turning point one way or the other. 10-year yields are at 280 area. I think that's a big area. The S&P between this 2680, 2700 ballpark area. NASDAQ 7400, transports around 10 grand, gold around 1250, 1200. These are neighborhoods here in July that I think may be quite a bit different in the months of October, November, December. And if the winds of change were to blow, you know, dollar index, if it blew to the downside, that could make the gold in the 1200, 1250 area be very inexpensive, and you could get some pretty good action on that by the end of the year. As far as the S&P is concerned, you know, if things are going to break the way Trump is talking, which is GDP is going to surge dramatically, we're going to have a red wave, earnings are going to jump dramatically, buybacks are going to kick in big time, repat money, and these tax returns are really going to kick in, and the consumer is going to continue to spend a ton of money. If that's the way it's going to break, then this neighborhood that we're going to see in the next, 6 to 8 weeks, could be a very, very significant opportunity. And for those who'd like to look into that further and get more information on the DVDs at Option Professor, the email is optionprofessor@gmail.com. And I certainly would invite any inquiries that people might have and if they'd like to hear my opinion on things.
Excellent. Hope people take you up on that and check out Neil's site as well, traderreview.net. Thanks again to both of you for coming, and it was great getting to talk to both of you. It was an interesting conversation today, I think. You can find me at investiquant.com, and I write a nightly letter there called The Navigator, which looks at the systems I discussed, our swing edges systems, and makes market calls based on what they're saying. And you can take a free trial to that anytime, a 7-day free trial. So check it out at investquant.com. It's the Navigator is the name of the letter. And I also write at quantifiableedges.com. Quantifiableedges.com, a couple things. The Fed-based quantifiable edges for stock market trading, I would encourage you to go ahead and download that. That's available for free. You can just sign up for that. And the other thing which I was going to push today, I mentioned, was my MS fundraiser. If you, you just go to the last blog post I did at Quantifiable Edges, it's called Wonderful Generosity from Quantifiable Edges Readers. If you go there, you can get the details on the QE blog. And all you need to do is make a donation of any size to the MS Society at my page. And you can get my Fed Day book, which I wrote several years ago. You'll get that. And you'll also get a $25 coupon for anything at Quantifiable Edges. Or if you donate at least $35, you'll get a $50 coupon along with the Fed Day book. So I'd appreciate it if anyone wanted to do that. That's great. Trade idea for the week. My exposure right now is I'm long the indices. So I'm looking for a bounce, in the S&P up to, I'm looking at SPY right now. So I'd be saying for SPY up to maybe 270, 250 or 274, I'd be getting out in that area. So I'm hoping for another couple dollars, before I'd be looking to close out. But I think we could get it, could continue to get a bounce here. And if you want to put in an area where you get stopped out, it'll probably be below the recent lows that Jim was talking about earlier, around that 2690 for the S&P. So that's it for me. Thank you for listening again, David. Thank you for having me, and Neil and Jim again. Thanks for thanks for joining me and getting to talk to you guys. A real pleasure.
Yeah, thanks guys. Great show. Just a reminder for everyone: be sure to subscribe to Timing Research on YouTube and your favorite podcast service. You can also go to timingresearch.com to get access to any of the past reports or shows. The Analyze Your Trade show will be off tomorrow, but both will be back next week. Crowd Forecast News will be July 9th, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and the next episode of Analyze Your Trade will be July 10th, 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And I just want to thank my guests again for this week: Neil Batho of TraderReview.net, Jim Kenny of OptionProfessor.com, and Rob Hanna of Investiquant.com and QuantifiableEdges.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.